This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 213 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from shuddersincpodcast.com, and joining me on the line via Skype from Melbourne, not one of them, but two of them, I have Mr. Glyn Lavender.
Hello.
Hi, Glyn. How are you?
Absolutely marvellous.
Excellent. And we are also joined by Australia's Mr. Colour expert, Les Walkling. Welcome back.
Indeed. Thank you.
How have you been?
I've been just fine. A little busy, but calm and
well, busy is good. Fine. Busy is good.
Frantic is terrible. Yes.
Yeah, I'll go along with that.
What's this word calm you say? I don't understand the terminology. What? It's not in my nature.
Every day has to be a Sunday, as far as I'm concerned.
So what sort of things have you been working on lately, Les?
Oh, dear, where to start? Now, I'm part of this collaborative, you probably are aware, 90 Degrees 5 ND5, consisting of myself and Christian and Michael Fletcher, Peter Eastway and Tony Hewitt. And
yep.
We've been doing our lecture tours around the country. We did Melbourne a few weeks ago at the State Library there, and we've got a day up in Sydney on the 7th of April at the Maritime Museum, where we're presenting our research and everything from the last few projects, screening our films and in general. So that's been occupying a huge amount of time. It's a massive production, as you can imagine.
Now, when you say screening your films, am I to read into that that you're shooting a lot of DSLR video these days, or do you just mean slide presentations?
Well, of the two Fletcher boys, yep. Michael, he's the filmmaker, he's the videographer.
Uh-huh.
He comes with us, the four photographers, Christian, Peter, Tony and myself, and he records our combined adventures. He's number five on the ND5 logo. and he just makes some incredible things, so much so that there's a lot of TV interest and all sorts of stuff in what we've been up to.
Nice.
So, yeah, and so Southwest Light and ND5, The Journey So Far, which is his latest 30-minute feature presentation. That's a feature of our Southwest Light presentations around the country, where we're presenting this in cinemas, in theatres.
Wow.
Rather than lecture theatres or seminar rooms. I tell you what, I mean, you know, you talk about not printing your own images. I mean, seeing an image 15 metres across on the screen.
That would be awesome.
And don't forget, these images are coming off medium format backs, 80 megapixel, or my wow. case, my 200 megapixel Hasselblad digital SLR. Well, it's hardly a digital SLR, more like an 8x10 view camera with a digital back on it.
Yeah, right.
It's 15 metres in a cinema with 500 people on the edge wow. of their seats. Pretty unbelievable.
That would be awesome.
We've been doing great stuff. Joe Quayle, our composer from London, came over to a special screening and performance in Perth in January, and that was stunning. So yeah, no, look, we've been busy but having a lot of fun.
You have someone custom scoring the music for you?
Jo is an extraordinary story. She found our Pilbara project on the internet. Of course, it's all over the bloody internet. I mean, you know, we did so much of this for several years, and it's been exhibited all over the place, and the book sold out and then sold out again. But the Pilbara Project, she found it, and she has had this extraordinary, it's almost that anti-Antipodean relationship with Down Under. She's one person from London who doesn't call us a bunch of convicts, and she fell in love with this extraordinary country that we now call home. So much so that she looked at our photos and they just spoke to her, and she composed a whole suite, a concerto called The Pilbara Project, which she performed with our images in London and elsewhere around Europe, and offered free, we pay her now of course, but offered free this most extraordinary score, which Michael just fell in love with.
And wow.
Actually ended up cutting parts of his film to moments in the score. So the collaboration, we still call ourselves ND5, but we've got our pilot, Peter, and his plane, and we've got Jo and her orchestra, and on it goes. It's rather interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You're not wrong.
Is there a DVD release coming somewhere down the track?
Oh, yeah, we've been selling hot. Every time we do one of these presentations, we sell out. We can't burn enough Blu-rays or DVDs for each event. So,
wow.
Yeah, no. It's all on the go. But it is stunning. I mean, Michael is – he's the same age as Christian. They're identical twins, of course. But
right.
While Christian's had this, you know, fully fledged, you know, landscape – commercial landscape, you know, umpteen galleries all over Western Australia, commercial success. Michael yep. has been the silent partner, you know, designing the gallery and doing the books with his wife and, you know, doing all the other stuff while Christian's out there, rock star Christian, taking these amazing images. So it's only like the last 7 or 8 years that Michael has been shooting film. And of course, now with these remarkable DSLRs, as you say, in the Pilbara, it was extraordinary. I mean, we were having to fly in and helicopter into all sorts of places, cart gear in, and we were able to take mini boom cranes, and we've got shots, you know, crane shots, you know, like in the middle of the Pilbara, which they tell us is as ice Antarctica in terms of distance from a capital city, flying around, and all we had to do was borrow a couple of weights from the local police gym in Port Hedland to counterbalance the camera.
Nice.
Think of previous times.
Yeah.
You would have needed a bloody 747 to fly the camera just to film what we were doing.
Exactly.
So, it's amazing, Bruce. It's
now, Les, one of the reasons I got you on, apart from, you know, giving you a chance to talk about the lecture tour, was the notion that there are a lot of listeners to this podcast, and I'll confess I'm not one of them, and I think Glyn would confess he's not one of them either.
Hey, speak for yourself, Bruce. Let me confess all by myself. Yeah, I'm not one of them either.
I'm a shocker. I don't print my images, at least certainly not enough. But there are people who listen to this podcast who do love to print their images, and those...
We met him too once.
Yeah, that's right. And enter those prints into, you know, photographic competitions. Now, the last time we had you on, we talked all about profiling your monitor. And I thought, let's get you back and have a chat about profiling printers, paper selection, ink selection, all that kind of stuff that, you know, anyone considering printing their own images to then enter into a photographic competition would need to consider. And I'll just hand the floor to you and let you run away with that topic if that suits you.
Oh, what a wonderful opportunity. Those 11 p.m. phone calls that I get, you know, the ones you always answer because someone's normally dead or dying, and often at the hands of Photoshop. You always pick up at 11 p.m. They're not trying to sell you something you don't want at 11 p.m. Guess what? My number one and my number two questions have been in the last year and a half or so. The first is, Les, my prints are too dark.
Yep.
The second is, Les, my prints are not only too dark, they don't in any way, shape or form look like what's on my screen.
Yep.
It's like a pandemic sweeping the world. So it would be an absolute, for those of us who still print, that is, who have the courtesy of returning the image to the world from which it came as a real object. How's that?
Glyn, consider yourself and myself suitably bitch slapped.
No, I didn't mean, but you
sure. Take it back now. Yeah.
I tell you what, though. The workshops I do all the time, the ones at the Centre for Contemporary Photography here in Melbourne, these weekend workshops, I always, no matter whether it's camera and lens or processing or archiving or compositing Photoshop, no matter what the workshop, I always say, now who's printing? How many people are, you know, returning the image to the world from which it came? I have been blown away in the last 12 or so months how many people are printing. There was that hiatus for maybe a year and a half.
Okay.
In 2011, going into 2012, where a lot of people were drowning in images, not finding images, not mm-hmm. able to locate images they shot yesterday. I'm sure they're on this bloody hard drive somewhere. So cataloguing became a huge issue, metadata libraries and such forth. That became a big issue, but people were still printing, but not like the numbers that had previously been doing it. Well, I've seen this extraordinary resurgence, at least through my CCP workshops. And, you know, 23% of the people come from interstate. So it's, you know, it's not an unreasonable sample, you know, to think of what other people elsewhere are doing in this country. It's extraordinary. So how timely, Bruce. I think this is a very, very good topic. So what about the number one question? Les, my prints are too dark. Now, I think this is an example of how easily, unfortunately, we are hoodwinked these days into believing advertising law or what someone tells us on the end of a phone or goodness knows, you know, what we read on an unvetted web page.
Yep. Some podcast you might listen to.
No, it's just that, I mean, it's really hard, isn't it? We're even teaching primary school children, you know, warrants. I mean, how do you know this information is something that you can rely on? I mean, we even have to teach this in primary school. It's a wonderful thing. Now, the difficulty is that, and this is the difficulty with all photography, you've got to know a little bit about everything to know anything at all about anything. Right? It's like you can't just learn apertures and diffraction. You'll never make an exposure unless you also know how to freeze motion with shutter speeds and ISO and controlling noise and composition and where to place the plane of focus. So you have to know a little bit about everything in order to know anything at all. So it's the same with printing. Now we have a trifecta. We have our image on the screen floating there in AC, DC, Lightroom, Photoshop, Aperture, Capture One, whatever takes your fancy. In my case, of course, Focus, the free software from Hasselblad, which I love. And so we've got this magical image just floating somewhere in cyberspace in this beautiful, beautiful thing we called a monitor. Now, then we have ourselves and our vision, which of course is extraordinarily variable. You know, we turn a light on and we adapt to that environment. We walk outside and we quickly adapt to that environment. So we're incredibly variable in our perception and what we choose to see. And then we've got this thing called a print, which appears a fixed object, but you then carry that around the world with you from tungsten lighting to fluorescent lighting to daylighting and so on. And that changes its characteristics. It's called inconstancy. So it's quite a complex system. So let's break it down. Let's assume that we've got our screen calibrated, whatever that means to the listener. To me, that means using a colorimeter, a smart device, an objective device, not something like me who wakes up grumpy one morning or with a smile on my face the next, but something it's the same today, tomorrow, yesterday, and into the future. And I've used the software that comes with that colorimeter, like a data color spider, for example, to then puck my screen and calibrate it to an ISO standard. And of course, all of this software, it just says recommended color temperature, recommended brightness, Les, recommended gamma. How do I get from black to white, in other words? And that's ISO 3664. So we're beginning in good company. So let's say we've got our screen calibrated. Let's say we've then got a beautiful printer profile, hopefully a custom printer profile that accurately describes how our printer, its ink set, and our paper all react together to completely and utterly bugger up color so that the profile can unbugger the color in our print chain, sight unseen by us, until the print comes out looking gorgeous. Let's just say those two situations are under control. Or if you haven't got a custom profile, at least that you've downloaded from the manufacturer's website, good faith included, their generic profile for your printer and ink model, your operating system.
So can I just jump in with a question there?
Yeah, sure.
Does the printer profile only refer to the way your computer talks to the hardware of your printer, or does the printer profile also include variables like the type of ink that you're using and the type of paper you're printing on?
Yeah, absolutely, the latter. Like a characterization. Yeah, think of it like a characterization. A profile knows the characteristics of the printer, ink, and paper, and the conditions in the computer, in an application like Photoshop or Lightroom, and how that data those numbers are being sent to the printer. So it's a, I mean, I'll give you a very simple example. Let's say my gorgeous Epson printer over here, let's just say it adds 20% too much red to every file I send through it. The profile will know that characteristic, 20% too much red.
Presumably that's a designed characteristic, though. It's not because your printer's faulty, right?
No, it's just individual. It's just individual difference.
Right.
It's individual difference. Okay, the Epson Pro printers in the factory in downtown Tokyo are calibrated to within quite narrow limits before they leave the factory. Mm-hmm. Still, there is great variance between one Epson 9900 and the next. Now, with other printers, say the Epson desktop non-pro printers, there's much, much greater variance. And as you go through the other manufacturers, there's enormous variance between printers of the same make and model, just as there are with cameras, just as there are with monitors. I mean, have you been to one of those appliance stores recently and seen the test on 15,000 televisions?
Yeah.
Spare. Though it's the same signal going to each TV set, LED or LCD, it doesn't matter. You'd swear they were playing on a different continent at a different time of the year, you know.
Yeah, there's no two that look the same.
This is why we have to calibrate the aberrations, the variance, the madness in our beautiful cameras, monitors, printers, to characterize them so that when I send my file to my printer and it adds, does its dastardly act and adds 20% too much ink to my file, too much red, let's say, then guess what? I get correct red out because the profile has already removed that 20% too much red from my image. That's how it works. That's how it works with our monitor profiles and our printer profiles. So if we're not printing in a, there's that word again, color-managed environment, then we've got to ask ourselves what the hell we're doing, because we're not actually playing by the rules of the game. You know, the color management is like the umpire of digital imaging. It is how things work together. Hmm. And if you're not playing by the rules of the game, well, then you're playing some other game. Now, that can be fun, of course. Let's just see what happens when I press this button. And there are people out there, I've got good mates who take photographs just to see what the world looks like as a photograph. Nothing the matter with that. Their productivity is not that great. They don't get to exhibit that many images that they're happy with because most of them are rejects while they press another button and see what happens. But it's what makes them feel their joy about photography. They love the button pushing.
Yeah.
You know, they love the madness. And occasionally they get something that exceeds their expectations. And that is worth the journey.
Yeah.
But my mates, like my mate Tony and Peter and Michael and Christian, for whom time is money because they're professionals, they have to hit Control P and have coming out of their printer every time perfectly a perfect print, because they just can't keep their customers waiting around. Oh, look, let me have another go, and look, would you mind coming back in 3 or 4 weeks and maybe I'll have a print by then? It just work.
So to get back to question number one, that you get 11 o'clock at night, that my print has come out too dark. Why is that such a common problem?
Well, it's because we've got to complete this trifecta, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the monitor being calibrated to an ISO standard. We've talked about the printer being calibrated to a basic standard. We haven't talked about us and our perception of the print, and most importantly, the light under which we view that print, and try and make a judgment about that print relative to its appearance on the screen. Now, here is I call it bucket technology. Do you remember the good old days of real photography, film photography, where something you bought at Safeway or Coles was as much value in your darkroom as something you bought at the local camera store, you know, a bucket or a spade, for example? This is bucket technology at its best in the world of digital imaging. In Photoshop, on my calibrated monitor, I just make a new blank file, a white empty rectangle, and I fill the screen with that 255 red, 255 green, 255 blue levels of brightness.
Mm-hmm.
On my screen, I've got screen white. Then I take a sheet of my beautiful paper. We'll talk about papers in a second. The beautiful paper I've chosen to invest my image in, to print my image on, but with no image on it, just white paper. I hold that under my print viewing light in my print viewing conditions. I hold it up, I squint a little bit, and unless the white of my screen and the white of my printing paper are a very, very close match in both brightness and color, then I cannot even begin to talk about any sort of correlation between the image on my monitor and the image as a print.
Right.
The reason I believe, and certainly when I go to people's studios and homes and help them fix this problem, my prints are too dark, the first thing that I do is I measure the brightness of their viewing light, and the second thing I do is I measure the brightness of their monitor, and almost always, I mean the exceptions I can count on one hand out of hundreds of cases, almost always people are running the brightness of their screens way too bright and consequently way too contrasty. And therefore the print, though it may be made with an accurate profile on beautiful paper with beautiful ink, ends up looking too dark relative to their screen.
I am so happy to hear you say that, because almost every, I know in a perfect world we'd all be using ISO monitors, but the reality is we can't all afford them. But in the range of domestic monitors that most of us are using, the instruction manual always tells you to crank the, you know, the brightness all the way up to 100.
Well, I was in an Apple store early, and I felt like putting my sunglasses on. I felt by these magnificent screens. The point is, that is fantastic for writing love letters or playing online games or surfing the web or closing your eyes while listening to a podcast. That's fantastic. But if when we are asking the monitor to reference something else other than the internet, when we're asking it to reference, to stand in for a print, we better bloody well make it look like a print. Otherwise, we will always be disappointed. Now, you see the distinction there? It's about what am I referring my monitor to? What am I asking my monitor to do for me? With my, sure, I've got state-of-the-art ASOs. I'm looking at one, two, three right now. I couldn't live without them. But I've also got, and I'm doing this podcast through my MacBook Pro, which has you know, a beautiful, you know, non-glossy high-res screen on there, but it's nothing as a screen compared to the ASO behind it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I can't calibrate that with my data color spider. I can't calibrate that to a known standard and make a calibration for my screen. It's called, for want of a better description, now let my screen look like a print, a reflective print, rather than a transmitted image that it really is.
Mm-hmm.
My ASOs, where I've got this extraordinary ability to hardware calibrate them so I don't hurt my image at all on its way to the monitor, just trying to make up for the fact that I can't change the characteristics of my Apple screen, my ASO screen, I can change the hardware characteristics. Even with that control, I still make a number of profiles for that monitor. Not just one profile. I make a profile that turns that screen into the internet. Dumb it down to sRGB, you know, satanic RGB, the internet. Yeah. And then I have another profile, which at the click of a button I swap to, which is wide gamut, Adobe RGB, all the colors almost that my beautiful Hasselblad or Nikon can capture, and so on and so forth. And so this screen just changes at the touch of a button from being one monitor to another monitor. Then I decide, and Bruce, this is about workflow as well. You know, what do I do first, second, third, and last? And when I download my images and start editing them, I, at that stage, normally have no idea what I'm going to do with these images, what printer I'm going to print them on, how large, how small, how intimate, or how public. I have no idea what paper I will use, and I don't even know if that will end up as a print or it might end up on one of Michael's films as a back. Who knows?
Yep.
So I have my monitor set up to ISO 3664, 6,500 degrees Kelvin roughly, gamma 2.2, and I take my brightness down though, well down to about 80 candelas, because even though I'm editing my image relative to just an internet standard, what I'm really doing though is also starting to look at it as if it was a print. Now that's just my prejudice because, you know, I'm a printmaker first, second. Sure. But I've got my screen it's not a perfectly focused, it's just slightly biased in its brightness towards making a print. Now this just saves me time and energy later on if I take that image through to a print, rather than leaving my screen on maximum brightness to begin with, because then I'd be seeing an unrealistic rendering of my image. But in my workflow, after I've worked my image up in this generic sort of space, this generic look, I'm referencing it to nothing in particular apart from this ISO standard. And by the way, 80 candelas is right on the money in that ISO standard I'm talking about. So I'm just working according to this standard. And that standard, by the way, is the standard that we calibrate screens to that are being used to work independently of printed output. So I'm not looking at prints at this stage, I'm just looking at my screen. When I decide, if I decide, gee, you know, I'd like to see how this print looks on Canson Platine, because that's my favorite paper. Let's just see what Canson Platine can do to this image. Let's see how much of that three-dimensionality that photographing the world takes away from the image. Let's see how much of that three-dimensionality, like a good sculptor I really am, I can put back into my image by making it a print and returning it to the world. So then I get all kind of really excited. Yes, let's make a print. But of course, my screen is not even close to referencing my print. So I then load my second monitor profile, my alternative monitor profile, calibrated to, you know, a different ISO standard, of course, that is all about having a chance of comparing, as I told you before, white point with white point, pairing a print to a screen under viewing lights. Now, then I continue my workflow, except now I tweak my image on the screen as if it is already a print, because my screen is now displaying my image with this second monitor profile that helps adapt my screen so it looks more like a print than the internet. Does that make sense?
I think so.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the biggest mistake we all make is to think that this magical thing called a monitor is just the be all and the end all, and we believe it with a faith that borders on religious fever. Most misplaced conception I have ever come across in my life. It's a form of fundamentalism that just does not make sense. Now a monitor is just an output device. Most people think the monitor is the computer. No, it's an output device, no different to a printer or a $10 million printing press in the factory down the road, mm-hmm. or data projector in the ceiling above me, or my film recorder over there where I write files back. It's just a damn output device. Therefore, it needs to be told what to do and how to behave itself. We begin with profiling it, but as our workflow becomes more sophisticated, as time becomes money, or as, hey, I just don't want to waste half my life trying to get a good print and five boxes of paper along the way. I want to get a bloody good print on the first file that I send through to my printer. Then we need to have our screen being able to act more like a soft proofing, you know, a facsimile, a simulation of a print. We need to calibrate it. And I've given you the big hint about brightness,
yep.
Which is why is my print, you know, looking too dark, because your damn screen's too bloody bright. Turn the brightness down until it matches the whites of your printed page. Then we start to adapt the screen to a new condition, which is, guess what I'm doing now, Bruce? I'm in Photoshop, Lightroom, Capture One, whatever, and I'm editing my image because I'm about to print it. And I want to see on my screen the appearance of my file as if it was a print.
Yep.
We can't do that with that Apple Cinema display, that MacBook Pro, straight out of the Apple shop, yes?
No.
Because as good as they are not calibrated to reference anything except themselves, not a print. So that's kind of a short summation of this problem.
Perfectly explained.
And so, now I can wipe the sweat off.
Yeah, if you just break it down to the very simple thing that the screen is exactly that, it's an output device, it's not a print, yep. Don't believe your screen. Simple as that.
Yeah.
Make it simple. You know, what you see isn't what you get. Live with it. Fix it.
If you want your screen, which is what it's designed to do, to be able to predict more or less accurately what your print is going to appear like, that's when you go to stage two. Calibrate your screen to match your print.
Exactly.
Now, an ASOS screen makes it a walk in the park because they're designed to do such things. You've got all the controls at your fingertips, and it takes me literally 12 minutes to teach someone with their ASO how to do this, and then they just practice, like shutter speed. With my beautiful MacBook Pro, you know, it takes a lot more effort to force it, and even then it's never as accurate. Oh my God, I've got a beautiful portable computer. I can be in the airport tomorrow morning on the way to Adelaide. I'll be doing email, doing all sorts of stuff, sending texts home, goodness knows what, from this dumb portable device. It's a bit too much to ask it to also be an ASO monitor. I think we'd be paying times the price for the privilege of that. So horses for courses. But I come home, I plug it into my high-end, beautiful desktop screen with hardware calibration, and I can make my image now look just like the print that's about to come out of my printer. You see, this is about efficiency, not just accuracy. It's about productivity. I went into a friend's studio many years ago. He was I won't name names, but he was he's like one of Australia's leading car photographers. He's a commercial boy. And he shoots with, you know, phase one, medium format, you know, nothing but the best. And he's the sort of guy that, you know, has army helicopters dropping the Mercedes-Benz at the base camp of Mount, you know, for a shoot. I mean, Hollywood production stuff. Unbelievable. He said, Les, I get you around. I need to print my new portfolio, you know, to spruik at the beginning of the year for more clients. I said, oh, no problem. It'll be a pleasure. I rock up because, of course, he needs his calibrated. Mm-hmm. I see, and these are A2 boxes, not A4. I'm talking A2 boxes of paper. I'm seeing about 8 or 9 50-sheet A2 boxes of paper stacked one above another, all different makes and brands of paper. I wet myself, you know, in the best possible way. I go, oh my God, I'm going to be all day. I'm in seventh heaven. Look at Les. No. Open the boxes. And I open the box. Instead of seeing pristine sheets of paper just waiting to accept a magnificent image, what do I see? Nothing but reject after reject. There must have been $2,000 worth of paper.
Hello.
Ouch.
And I just looked at him and I said, you idiot. You've been doing this all Christmas. Yep, all Christmas. I said, why the hell didn't you call me? You know, I don't go away in January. You know, it's the best time in Melbourne. No one's around. So I just walk the streets, you know, footloose and fancy free. I'm around. And so by the end of the day, his 5 papers were profiled. They were in place. And guess what? The first print that came out looked just like his screen. And that 10 years ago, nothing has changed today except our monitors now are 10 times brighter, 10 times more contrast, and therefore when it comes to photography as a print, as a publication in a book, a journal, a magazine, as a poster, as a t-shirt, as a coffee mug, as a vinyl banner on the outside of the National Gallery of Victoria, or as a fine print exhibited on the walls within, under all those conditions, the screen and its excessive brightness and contrast, of course, leads us up the garden path. And no wonder my vinyl banner, my exhibition print, my coffee mug or t-shirt are too dark. Okay?
Yeah.
It's my case. Hey, yes. 255 RGB on this monitor. Hold your printer paper up under your viewing conditions. See if the color and the brightness match. And if they do, pat yourself on the back or get someone to pat you on the back because you're doing well. Cool? If you're not, if you haven't those conditions, well, then there's heaps of room for improvement, and it's not hard to achieve. I should say, I'm saying all this stuff, and I hope I'm not confusing people, but you know, if this was a workshop, I would be directing them to my homepage under my Words tab.
Yep.
And under my Words tab, you know, this is at leswalkling.com.
Yep.
Three L's, you miss one L, leswalkling.com. Yep. Miss one L, you miss everything, right? So on the front page, under my Words tab, you know, not home, not history, not images, courses, services, contact, under Words, the first tab down is the theory of practice, technical papers. All the other stuff there is just art history and philosophy and artist statements. It's a top, it's stuff up the top that's the meat of it. Under technical papers, theory of practice, under my Words tab, there's a whole range of technical papers there. The very first is called Monitor Theory. Click on that, a simple three-page PDF. The one under it, which talks all about calibrating monitors and the ISO standards and how to adapt them to your conditions. And when in doubt, do this. And the second paper is called Soft Proofing Theory. That's a bit longer. It's about a 17-18 page. But that goes into some detail exactly what I've been talking about. And the 18th page, of course, I can't say buy an Azo monitor because I can't afford it. What is that? On the 18th page, I show you how to do this in Photoshop without spending a cent.
Oh, lovely.
And this is how we used to do it prior to 1993, 94, when we first got our hands on what we now know as ICC color management. And really? I know it because I've even talked in the mid-90s, I've even talked to a postgraduate student of mine over the phone. She was in a foreign country. She was having to set up a printer to print, and I even talked this method of Photoshop to adjudicate the difference between the screen and printed image, and it worked. And it worked even across international datelines. So I know this stuff works. But of course, if you want to do it properly, that is, without all the labor, pick and shovel work of Photoshop and all of its aberrations and errors, then of course I also explain. So if I don't know if you have a web page to the podcast or anything, but if you're able to put that
in. Yeah, I will put the links up in the show notes, Liz, don't you worry.
I'm not leaving people stranded, you know?
No. Absolutely. Now, Glenn, have we got you back on the line?
Yes, you do.
Oh, good.
Well, I just went in for a coffee and the joys of modern internet. Yeah, we thought Les might fall out and it was me instead.
Yeah, exactly.
He's sucking my power.
Now, Les, we were going to chat about some other stuff. Are you going to hang around and have a chat with us?
Delighted to.
Excellent. Now, Glenn, you were telling me before we started recording, you had something new and exciting that you wanted to share this week?
Well, a few things. Yeah. First up, we did forget to mention at the beginning of the show that because we've got 100 fans on our Facebook page, this is the free episode.
We're giving
this episode of the webcast out for free this week. As opposed to all the other weeks where there's no cost.
That's right. Exactly.
Very different. Look, I've come across a few things this week. First up, for anyone who's looking to do something a little bit interesting this winter, a friend of mine in Banff in Canada is looking for some photographers, some retail staff to help her out over their very, very busy summer period.
Right.
So any sort of young backpackerish photo enthusiast who's looking for a job, look up banffphotography.com. Get in touch with Lisa Otto, who runs the place, and tell her I told you about it, and see what she's up to.
Wow. That'd be nice.
If I was 25 years younger and no kids, I'd be 25 years younger and have no kids.
Exactly.
And I'd probably go there as well. Banff, one of the most beautiful places in the world, as I'm sure you've been there before.
I've not been to Canada, no.
Well, you've got to put an A on the end of everything, but other than that, it's a fantastic place. So that was pretty cool. I thought maybe there's some people out there listening who's looking for a bit of adventure and a bit of a change to their life, which is kind of cool.
During the Northern Hemisphere summer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a good opportunity. And not a bad place to shoot if you like your odd landscape or two.
I can imagine. Yeah.
You've been there before, I'd imagine, have you, Les?
I have indeed. I have indeed. Yes.
Remarkable place, isn't it, to shoot?
Remarkable was an understatement, yep.
Whereabouts in Canada are we talking, like, geographically?
Oh, it's right smack bang in the middle of the Rockies.
Right, so it's sort of towards...
On the Bow River.
Towards the west
side. It's halfway between Vancouver and Calgary.
Right.
Maybe three hours or so outside of Calgary into the Rockies.
Right.
The mighty Bow River there, an incredible place. One of the most scenic places you'll probably ever see in the world, so...
So you've been there, Glenn?
Yeah, many times, yeah.
Right.
I used to live in Vancouver, and I used to commute in some ways to Alberta to visit friends and family. So I've been through there many times.
Wow. We've got a bit of a recurring theme here with hosts of this podcast who've lived in Canada.
Well, you know, it's I think it's actually part of the job description, wasn't it?
I think it must have been, yeah.
So that was one thing. And something else came across my desk today, which I thought, well, by my desk, I mean, of course, it's my couch in front of the TV whilst I'm pretending to work.
Yeah.
There's a new photo show workshop experience thing going to be happening in Sydney in end of May, early June that I thought... tell the folks about.
Right, and what's that show called?
It's called the Digital Playground, it's called.
Oh.
And it's part of the Vivid Festival.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they're sort of incorporating a much greater photo theme around it. And, there's going to be demonstrations, there'll be workshops, seminars, there'll be pop-up tours, there'll be... what else is it? There's going to be a big trade show. Well, Australia's open to the public. We can go see the product and talk to actual Olympus and Canon and Nikon themselves and so on. So that's all going to be in the old overseas passenger terminal.
Oh, okay.
And they're on the harbour foreshore, which would be pretty interesting. So I thought that could be kind of cool.
Yeah, well, it's funny that, well, I suppose it's deliberate that they've hosted it there, because the moment you said it's part of the Vivid Festival, I immediately think of the lighting of the opera house that they do every year. I don't know if you're familiar with it. They shine these coloured lights and have all these moving animations play across the shell of the opera house each year. It's quite spectacular to watch.
So yeah, they've been incorporating obviously how to shoot night photography. They'll be doing sort of evening seminars. You'll be able to go out and walk and learn how to shoot that stuff, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
That's been brought to you by the same people who run the main photo expo around the country. It used to be called PICA, P-I-C-A. It's now IDEA.
Right.
I have no idea what IDEA stands for, but they're lovely people. And it's part of the PMA initiative as well, which I think Les is doing some stuff with, and I do quite a bit of stuff with. So that'd be pretty cool. I'm thinking of going up there and offering my services to do some evening flash workshops, going around and putting people in front of those incredible lit subjects would be kind of cool.
Absolutely.
So we'll put the link up to that for anyone who wants to learn more about it.
Now, one thing, as I mentioned in the last episode, Kath and Max and I are heading off to Borneo in June, end of June, start of July.
Soon,
yeah, exactly. And after you recommending the storm jacket last week, that got me thinking about lens choices and what gear I would take with me to Borneo. The international flights from Sydney to Singapore and Singapore to Kota Kinabalu are not an issue. There's a 30 kilo luggage limit per passenger, so that part of it's not a problem. What is an issue is the 10 days that we're actually on the Intrepid tour in country in Borneo. There is a 15 kilogram limit per passenger, and the reason for such a stringent limit on weight per passenger is because there's this tiny little aeroplane that's going to fly us back from the east coast of Borneo back to Kota Kinabalu, and that plane is apparently quite small, and hence why everyone has to travel light. So that's had me thinking over the last week, what lenses am I going to take? Now, I sent you an email, Glenn, with all of the lenses that I own, Which
and every possible combination thereof. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is what I'm thinking, and Les, I'd be keen to hear your thoughts on this. I own three primes, a 20mm wide-angle 2.8, a 50mm 1.7, and a 135 f2.8. And then I've got two zooms. One's a 28-75 2.8 Tamron, and then I've got just the old kit lens that came with my camera originally, which is a 75-300, but it's only, you know, f4 to f5.6. So I'm thinking, do I just take the three primes and buy myself a 2x teleconverter, which would at least then give me, on the 135, 270mm at f5.6, or do I leave the 135 at home and take the 75-300, but then I miss out on the beauty of 2.8 aperture? So these are all the things that are kicking around my head. So what are your thoughts, guys?
Well, I'm always asked, if you had to go to a desert island, what's the one lens you would take?
Yep.
And I always say, I've always had an answer to that, I'd always take my Tamron 18 to 270 because I'm sponsored by them and I have to. It's very important to get that in. And my 90mm macro, because I don't follow their rules. It's really simple. I'll take as many lenses as I need to. Look, it's pretty... I always like to think, well, what am I going to shoot? What do I think I'm going to be shooting?
Yep.
And what lenses are going to hopefully sort of hammer into that as best as possible? So what's your vision for Borneo?
I would imagine a lot of wildlife that's not necessarily going to be up close. So I'm probably going to want some focal length, which, you know, brings me back to, do I take the 75 to 300, even though it doesn't have the nice 2.8 aperture, it's just going to give me that bit more reach. Or do I, you know, like I said, buy a 2x teleconverter and go with the 135 and settle for 270mm as my longest reach.
A lot of speed of the lens, though.
Yeah, you'd lose two stops. So my 135 2.8 would become a 270 at 5.6.
Which is like your 300 5.6 anyway.
Yeah.
But it's also speed of focus. It's also a contrast issue as well. They do have a few of those elements as well.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you may have the reach but not the speed to catch what you're trying to capture anyway.
Right.
So that's a fact you have to take into consideration. And realistically, if you're shooting a baboon or something that's 400 meters away with your 300 mil or your 270, you're not going to be shooting at 2.8 anyway.
No.
Yeah, you're not going to need 2.8. 2.8's not going to make a difference to the shot.
No.
Artistically. So maybe the kit lens is okay for a compromise for that sort of situation.
Right. So maybe the kit lens and then the 20 and the 50 primes.
Oh, yeah, I'll do something wide, something for portraits.
I would never leave the house without my 20mm.
Yeah.
I just don't leave home without it. I love that lens.
That'd be the best compromise. The other advantage, of course, is the 75 to 300 being a kit lens. It's fairly light.
Yeah, it's certainly not as heavy as a 70 to 200 2.8.
Yeah, or even the 135 2.8, I would imagine.
No, that's actually quite a light lens.
Oh.
It's quite light. It's only a 55mm diameter, so it's not a...
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's a beautiful compact lens.
So it's always a tough decision. You know, everywhere I travel, people ask me the exact same question. Yeah, what was the least amount of gear you would take? And I'd say, well, it has to be everything. Yeah, I've got lots of tricks for getting my 20 kilos of camera bag onto the plane.
Right.
But if the plane's so small that extra 10 kilos may make it plummet,
yeah.
I'm a little bit more careful.
Maybe I just tell Kath and Max they have to carry less gear so they can carry some of mine.
That's a fair compromise. I thought they're going to be buying lots of stuff. So when you do the plane trip, what's at the end of that when you get back? What's the rest of your trip at the end of that?
What happens is we leave Kota Kinabalu on this 10-day thing, and I think it's about the sixth or seventh day that we, because Kota Kinabalu, if you're not familiar with Borneo, is over on the northeastern corner of Borneo, and over the first 6 or 7 days of the tour, we eventually end up over on the western side of Borneo, and then we catch this little plane that flies us back across the island to Kota Kinabalu, and once we land, the tour then continues on land for a couple of more days. But it's only that flight that is the issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, are you coming back to the same hotel after the flight? Can you leave stuff there?
Well, that's something I want to look into. We're not coming back to the same hotel, but we will need to organise some accommodation for after the tour ends, because we've got a couple of days in Kota Kinabalu after the tour ends, but before we fly back out to Singapore. So potentially we could go back to the same hotel. So that's an option to look at whether or not they have a safe or something where I could leave some stuff for the 10 days that we're gone.
For sure. The other thing I'll be looking at is what camera bag you're taking. I mean, my camera bags range from 4 to 7 kilos by themselves.
Yeah.
So, you want to be looking at, well, what's the least weight, the least amount of padding, the least amount of everything I can take.
Yep.
And, of course, limit your family to 3 kilos each.
Exactly.
It's pretty simple, really, It's time they sacrifice for your art.
That's right. Les, how do you find travelling? Do you run up against weight limits often?
Oh, all the time.
Right.
But I just think you've got to be really, really smart. I have 6.8 kilos. That's what I carry on, so that no one, even over the Alps in New Zealand, can kick me off at Air New Zealand Cessna. And and then everything goes in Pelican cases inside my suitcases.
And, right.
Or if those lenses don't turn up, if that other paraphernalia doesn't turn up, at least I've got basic kit with me. And I can always buy another surveyor's tripod if mine doesn't turn up. So
yeah,
right. I'll never plane without my basic kit. I've got my basic kit down to 6 kilos.
Yeah, nice.
And I've 100 times in the most, I'm kidding you, at the back out of Christchurch Airport, or going up to the Cook Islands, it's just making you get on the bloody scales with your bag as well. And I've seen dear friends of mine, some of my collaborators, going through the horrendous situation of pulling lenses apart and shoving them in suitcases, not knowing how the hell they're going to be bounced all the way back, over the islands. I just couldn't do that. So everything's packed properly and securely. I just divide it between the absolute minimum that I've got to have with me, and that's my favorite lens, your 20, all the way through to some pieces are in bags, in Pelican cases, locked inside, safe and secure. Yep.
Mm. The other issue I'm going to face too, and I only thought about this after we finished recording last week, Glenn, is that I don't know during that 10 days, in country in Borneo that we're sort of trekking around in the jungle, I don't know how much access I'm going to have to AC power.
Yep.
Which means so, I'm going
to... Solar. Solar. Get yourself some portable solar panels.
Ah.
Yeah, they'll trickle. You can get a little backpack with solar panels on the backpack that you can be charging as you're walking along.
Interesting.
Got to do what you got to do.
Well, yeah, exactly.
There's a little bit of weight to those backpacks, of course, but if it keeps your cans up by taking a camera and worrying about it, if you can't run it.
Yeah, exactly.
Out, so.
Exactly.
They're a trickle, but you might, even if you only get 20 or 30 shots a day out of it, it's 20 or 30 shots you wouldn't have had.
That's true. I shall look into that as well.
more research. Yeah. Let us know how you get on next week.
Exactly. Exactly.
A couple of tips for people who are traveling on bigger planes and worrying about carrying their gear, though. I've got it all down to a fine art.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with international travel. Because I carry about 20 kilos on board.
Right.
In my roller bag. But, there's a couple of tricks. First up, you always have a jacket.
Yes.
And you always lean that over the roller bag so it sort of hides its shape.
Yes.
Tip number one. Tip number two is wait for a group of people with very large amounts of bags to go through. On the other side, there's usually only two people checking for oversized bags.
Yep.
So if you follow through behind a big group, good chance they'll have been taking those two people out of action.
Ah, nice.
Always walk with the bag. So if you're going through into international and turning left, you have your bag on the left-hand side. So turn left on your right-hand side, have the bag on your right-hand side. If you're going through and turning right, you have it on your left-hand side. That way it's away from the person because they're usually on the inside of the door.
Right.
And then finally, if they object to the weight, you take out your cameras and your biggest lenses and wear them, get them to reweigh the bag. then the bag's usually okay, and you walk through with the bags, the lenses around your neck, go around the corner, put them back in. Nice. And I've done that many a time too. So they're my little tricks for getting excess baggage onto big planes. And as Les says, if you know you're going on a small one, well, you know, I've been quite a few float planes where that's the same sort of situation. They're very, very strict limits.
A similar trick that has occurred to me is that because quite often when I travel, I normally take my low pro roller. Is that if you are dragging it behind you on its wheels, you are more likely to get challenged to weigh it than if you turn it into backpack mode and put it on your back.
Yeah.
They never question you if you're wearing it as a backpack.
I never try and carry mine because my sweating brow makes it from the strain. makes it a little too obvious. Yeah, the bulging veins in the neck, the slightly florid complexion, that kind of stuff tends to be a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah, right.
Some have rollers these days anyway, you know, who are business types who are flying.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not an unusual thing.
I realise that, but I think the... Yeah, you know, when you see a camera bag as a roller, I don't know, they tend to be a little bigger than what the business people tend to use. Well,
yeah,
that has been my observation. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
It depends on which size bag you have, but I think if you can hide its bulk by putting a jacket through the roller arm, you know, the little handle, you put the jacket through there, kind of hides its bulk somewhat. Right. Yeah, and often hides the brand name. It's the brand name you're often looking for as well. So
yeah, right.
So it's all the joys of travel.
Excellent. Well, anything else we wanted to cover before we wrap it up, guys?
The one last little thing.
Yep.
I just came across another little interesting website this week, which I thought people may like to maybe watch over the course of the year, because it's going to build over the course of this next 12 months. And it's a National Geographic site. Yeah. Where they're celebrating their 125 years, and they're pulling all these photos out of the archives. So far, I think they've got 15 or 20 images on the site, and it's going to build over the course of the year, and they're back to like 1920s, 1930s, and it's kind of cool. So we'll put the link to that one up on the course notes as well.
Show notes, yeah.
The show notes. Because I don't hand out course notes at the workshop anyway, because I'm far too lazy.
Excellent. Yes, well, I'll get that link off you, Glenn, and we'll definitely include that in the show notes.
Done.
So, Les, the tour is coming to Sydney on the 7th of April, you said?
7th of April, and I should probably mention I'm doing a lot of events for PMA as well, Photo Marketing Association of Australia.
Yep.
Who have hosting that festival we talked about. I'm in Sydney on the 15th and 16th of May. These are Friday night Photoshop seminar and an all-day Photoshop workshop on the 16th Saturday, and that's in Melbourne, 22nd, 23rd, and Perth, 25th and 26th. The website's pmaaustralia.com.
Okay.
And they're pretty wonderful people. It's non-for-profit, everything, and it's just getting trying to help people tame the behemoth called folk, make it our best friend.
Cool. I'm supposed to be introducing you next Friday night, but I'll see if I can get in there or not. That was the last I heard, and I'm doing a series for PMA after you, so I think I'm doing the June series. So
yeah, no, they're coming up fast. Yep,
they are always too fast.
All right. Well, Les Welkeling, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And we will make sure we get all those links that you've mentioned tonight up in the show notes alongside this episode. And Glenn, I'll chat with you again next week, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, if you haven't already liked the Facebook page, please do so. It's facebook.com/Shutters Inc. Podcast. As Glenn mentioned,
if we get to 200 listeners, we'll give another free podcast away. So.
Excellent idea.
I'm full of them.
All right, I'll talk to you next week, Glenn.
See you guys.
Bye.
Guys, bye.
Shutters Inc., another audio2you.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out shuttersincpodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@shuttersincpodcast.com.